Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. We have some controversy out there on Twitter between those who believe in deflation and others who believe we are going to see hyperinflation in the United States. We did a story yesterday, Jack Dorsey from Twitter and Square coming out and saying that he sees hyperinflation, not just in the United States, but all around the world. And then Kathy Wood from ARK Investments, I believe her fund is called, comes out and says, well, Jack is wrong. We're not going to have inflation. In fact, we are going to have deflation, not just disinflation, deflation, where prices go down significantly after Christmas. Her rationale is because the whole world is going to be run on robots. So prices are going to go down. And this is going to happen sometime right after Christmas. But that is part of her argument, but not the complete argument. So to dive into what she is saying, to determine whether or not I think she is right or wrong, let's head right over to this article from CNBC. Here we go. Title, Kathy Wood disputes Jack Dorsey's hyperinflation warning, says prices will fall after the holidays. The founder and CEO of ARK Invest took to Twitter to expound upon her contrarian theory about deflation after Dorsey tweeted Friday evening that hyperinflation is going to change everything. It's happening. Wood estimates that her hypothesis will start to play out sometime after the holidays. Okay, first thing I want to point out that Kathy didn't just come up with this hypothesis yesterday. She has had this deflation hypothesis for a long time now. In fact, I would say prior to the Cervasa sickness, she is always talking about how the future is deflation because of artificial intelligence and robots will be doing absolutely everything, and therefore prices are going to come down, and you guys know the story. So what happened in 2020 and so far in 2021? We definitely did not see deflation, although I think she would argue that we have seen major technological breakthroughs, or all these big tech companies are driving prices down with all of their incredible innovations. I would argue mostly censorship, but I think she would argue that these big tech companies are innovative. And if you don't jump on board with the Facebooks, the Google, the Tesla, then you are going to be left behind. But my point is she had this argument why prices would come down prior to 2020. And it didn't work out well for her in 2020. Nor has it worked out well for her in 2021. We've seen significant price increases, which points out why her analysis initially was flawed. Because number one, she doesn't understand how money's created. And I'll get into that in a moment. And I'm not just taking a dig at her. I think she's a very intelligent gal and extremely intelligent for that matter. But a lot of these hedge fund managers, what you'll notice is they may be really, really good at picking stocks and analyzing individual companies and maybe even seeing trends. I don't know if you would put Kathy in that category or not. Maybe some of you would, some of you would not. But very few of them understand macro. They think they do. But when you actually listen to what they say, you can tell they've got a very, very elementary understanding of how just the global economy and the dollar monetary system actually works. And we'll get into that in a moment here. But that's the first thing I point out, is that we, although she would argue we've had these deflationary pressures with all these advancements in technology, we had those throughout 2020 and 2021. But yet at the same time, we have seen prices of housing, energy, food go completely parabolic. So one other thought there is the reason she is making that mistake, or one of the main reasons, is because she's not really thinking about the supply line, or she's not thinking about the supply side of the equation. She's pretty much exclusively thinking about the demand side of the equation, which is understandable because she's most likely, any economics classes she has taken, I would assume, I don't know this, but I would assume they were taught by a Keynesian instructor. And therefore, the only thing that you're ever looking at is aggregate demand. And deflation is just the ultimate boogeyman. And we're going to, she hints at that later on in the article. So the first thing that shows me that she really doesn't understand, and it's not that she's not intelligent, I just don't think she's taken the time to research it. And when I talk about understand, I'm talking about global macro, really the dollar monetary system. In 2008 and 2009, when the Fed started quantitative easing, I thought that inflation would take off. I was wrong. So why was she wrong? She was wrong because she doesn't understand how the Fed's balance sheet works. She doesn't understand the relationship between the Fed's balance sheet and the commercial banking system. I don't think she really understood the relationship between the Fed, the TGI, and the TGA, excuse me, and whether or not dollars were a liability of the Fed, meaning bank reserves, or they were dollars of the commercial banking system. And how is inflation? How are dollars created that were circulating in the real economy? Well, they were created by the commercial banking system. So you have to get hyper-focused on their balance sheet, not necessarily the Fed's balance sheet. The Fed's balance sheet could go from $800 billion to $4 trillion, and it doesn't necessarily mean that there's additional lending happening in the real economy, which would create additional dollar assets on the balance sheets of the non-bank entities. And that's what you really have to be concerned with, because that's where you see velocity increase. Now, in aggregate total, you might not see velocity increase, but there can be, you've got to compartmentalize where dollars live. And all dollars are not created equal from the standpoint of velocity, you see? So you can have dollars created on the balance sheet of the non-bank entities in the real economy, and the velocity for those dollars can increase, while the dollars, the velocity of the dollars that are on the banking system's balance sheet, as an example, decrease. And therefore, on an aggregate total, the amount of the velocity goes down, even if you assume M2 is correct, which it is not. But even if you were assuming M2 is correct, the M2 money velocity goes down in that environment. But if you have enough supply chain issues, since you do have significant velocity or enough velocity in the private sector or with the average Joe and Jane, the non-bank entities in the real economy, you would have enough dollars and enough velocity circulating throughout the economy, especially when you have a decrease in supply, to create consumer price inflation, even though velocity in aggregate total goes down. And so I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here, but you can see what she says after she said she was wrong about the Fed. Instead, velocity, the rate which money turns over per year, declined, taking away its inflationary sting. Velocity still is falling. So number one thing here is she would... if she's talking about velocity and really using it as a metric that we should consider, that means she's taking M2 money supply at face value and assuming that is a correct measurement of dollars. And as you guys know from watching my videos, more specifically Jeff Snyder's videos, that's not true. The M2 money supply maybe shows us about 25% of the overall pie chart. The other 75% of dollars exist in the shadows. And we cannot quantify them. So velocity is simply a math problem. It's just you take the GDP and you divide it by M2 money supply, and there's velocity. But think about that. If you can't quantify the money supply, how are you getting to an accurate measurement of velocity? The answer is you're not. And you go back and look at the 1990s. Why didn't we have massive amounts of inflation in the 1990s? Did we have less money supply as measured by M2? Not really. It was pretty much flat, but velocity went way up in the 90s. Okay, well, then what happened there? And another chart that I'd point out, let's fire over to Twitter real quick. And this is something I tweeted out earlier in response to what Kathy was saying. And she's talking about velocity, and how velocity goes down. Therefore, we're going to have deflation. Or that's why she was wrong about deflation back during the GFC. And that's why she's correct about deflation today. But let's think that through here. Look at a chart of velocity. And this is M2 velocity. And if we're to assume that M2 is correct, which it isn't, but even using her measurements, let's say, or her metrics, we see that velocity tanked in 2020, and it's down at almost an all-time low right now in 2021. But what has happened to consumer prices? So if velocity was the be-all, end-all, if velocity was actually a good measurement or gave you some sort of predictive tool as to what may happen in the future with consumer prices, then we would have seen consumer prices absolutely plummet in 2020 and 2021. And of course, we have seen the opposite. So my point is, this kind of debunks what she was saying about the power of velocity as a predictive tool to try to determine the probability that inflation is going to be transitory, or if we're going to have absolute actual deflation in the future. Okay, so let's go back to the article. While many market participants are concerned about rising prices, the hot-handed investor expects deflation, we were saying before, amid a breakdown in commodity prices, a failure of companies that fell behind innovation. Come on. Come on. And that's going to happen right after Christmas. All these companies are just going to go completely bankrupt because they're not using artificial intelligence. Come on. And then companies stockpiling and innovation trends taking off. And there again, so right after Christmas, the grocery store, all of the energy producers, and the housing market is going to be so disrupted from technology that the prices are going to come down. And by the way, how does that work? Just, I'd like, maybe some of you know, maybe some of you are familiar with Kathy's work. How does innovation trends solve the problem of housing prices going up? There's certain industries that no matter how cool you think tech is, you're not going to solve the problem with technology because there's very, very low tech. And housing is a great example of that. At the end of the day, it's bricks and sticks. It's just commodities and people putting them together with their bare hands. And the process of building a house is pretty much the same today as it was back in the 1950s, in the 1960s. And in fact, I'd go back even further, you know, to the early 1900s. I mean, you look at the houses that were built back then, a lot of them are still standing in some urban areas. I'm thinking about Kansas City. I looked at a lot of them. And sure, the building standards were lower back then. And we've got a few, we've got a few things that we do now that make the stability of the overall building far superior. But as far as just how they were constructed and the materials that they were used that were used back then, it's pretty much identical to how it was today. So I would love to hear Kathy explain to me how innovation and technology is going to significantly reduce the price of housing. And also, once you consider that housing is, what, 30% of CPI? If technology can't bring down prices in housing, then how is it really going to move the needle for the overall CPI? Especially right after Christmas. You see where I'm going with this? I mean, certain people get out there on CNBC, and for someone that really doesn't think through these things or might not understand macro or might not understand how dollars are created or the global monetary system, all of this sounds plausible. It's all, oh my gosh, yes, what am I doing in these? And my oil stocks or the coal, I'm in uranium. Oh my gosh, what am I doing? I've got to run out and sell everything and buy Facebook and Tesla. But yet you kind of peel back the layers of the onion and you're like, wait a minute here. This doesn't really make too much sense. But let's keep going. So she says, now we believe there are three sources of deflation that will overcome supply chain induced inflation that is wreaking havoc on the global economy. Oh, okay, so again, this idea is the cure for high prices, meaning that well, sure, we see inflation right now, but it was completely unexpected because of the Cerveza sickness. Obviously, what I would say, it's not the Cerveza sickness, it was the government's response to the Cerveza sickness. But once things settle down and all of these suppliers get in all their double and triple orders that they've been doing, and that kind of comes through the supply chain, well, then things will settle back down and prices will go back down to where they were in 2019, if not lower, because the thrust of her argument is these supply chains will get fixed. And if the government doesn't do it by Biden just decreeing it into reality, like he was trying to do the other day at the port, if that doesn't fix it, well, good old high prices will fix it, because that will bring on additional supply, additional workers, etc. I think this is a short-sighted view, because this assumes that the government distortions that created the supply chain issues to begin with will not be there in 2022 and 2023. Or in other words, this means that the government regulations and restrictions that created these shortages and supply chain issues will not be present moving forward. I would add, this also assumes that they won't get even worse moving forward. Well, what do we see happening right now? We have the tightest labor market in human history in the United States. And what are the central planners doing? They're coming out and saying, yes, we know businesses, you cannot get employees. We know that you're having to produce less stuff because there's this massive labor shortage. And we know it is dramatically crushing the economy, and it's also increasing prices. But what we want you to do, despite all that, is we want you to fire 10 or 15% of your work staff that isn't willing to inject a foreign substance into their body. Think about that, the position that puts a business owner in. What do? You're already short-staffed. You're going to fire 15% of your workers? What is that going to do to supply chain bottlenecks? What is that going to do to shortages of supply? What is that going to do to a shortage of labor? It's going to make it far worse. And I don't think the government will stop there. I mean, just look at what we saw over the weekend, that that Yellen is calling for a tax on unrealized capital gains. So you say, well, that doesn't affect me, George. I'm not a billionaire. Okay, well, if we get enough inflation, everyone's going to be a billionaire. And if we don't get that much inflation, I can guarantee you they're going to bring the bar further and further down until probably most of you on this live stream will be included in that group. Why? Because incomes are going down. And the especially because so many people aren't working, and the majority of the revenue that was going to the federal government, a good portion of that was from payroll taxes. And although people may pay tax on stimmy checks, they don't pay payroll taxes. That's what most people don't really think through. So we can have this environment where incomes are actually going up, but because they're going up because of via transfer payments from the government, we see the tax revenues actually go down. And where will they try to make that up? Well, the only place they can is with asset prices, because now our whole entire economy revolves around asset prices. So they've got to figure out a way to tax capital gains, even if you don't sell. And the reason it's the probability is very high that it goes from billionaires to millionaires to pretty much everyone that is on this live stream right now is because they're not enough billionaires out there to generate enough tax revenue to compensate for their profligate spending and what they want to spend in the future. So the only way to fill that gap is if they somehow are able to tax the middle class, because that's a large enough group to where if they picked their pocket, it would actually move the needle. Now, I think they'll also try to pick their pocket through inflation, but that's a completely separate video. So let's keep moving on here. So that's kind of what my pushback would be regarding the supply chain issues from people who have that argument like Kathy Wood. They assume these supply chain issues will be fixed in the future. And I think that's an incorrect assumption. That's not a foregone conclusion, because we're going to have more and more government that is going to create more and more distortions, which is why we had the supply chain bottlenecks in the first place. Two sources are secular long-term, one is cyclical. Technology-enabled innovation is deflationary and most potent source. So this goes back to what I was saying before. Just, Kathy, please show me how technology is going to reduce the price of a house or rent or groceries. I mean, I kind of see how it may, if we just go straight GMO and start eating bugs like Klaus wants us to. Maybe. And like fake meat, like, or what is it? Gates wants us to eat some sort of weird lab created meat. Yeah, maybe that might bring prices down, but I don't think people are really going to be lined up around the corner to eat that stuff. And then tell me, how is it going to bring down energy? I mean, everything that they're pushing, the Kathy Wood types with this ESG movement, at least for the next 5 or 10 years, that's going to make energy prices go up, not down. We can see this playing out with natural gas in Europe. We can see it playing out with coal in China. So even if we move to wind and solar, you may think that's great, but for the next 5-10 years, while you make that transition, you're still going to have a significant amount of the demand for those, let's say, fossil fuel energies. And the majority of electricity right now is produced by coal anyway. And so you're going to have shortages of electricity, and then you're going to have the price of energy go up significantly, which is why we've seen uranium, why we've seen nat gas just absolutely go parabolic.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So ARK Innovation Portfolio Manager noted that training costs for artificial intelligence are dropping by 40 to 70% per year, which she believes is a record-breaking deflationary force. Okay, I don't know that Kathy has really looked into how the CPI is measured, nor do I think she's really thought through the percentage of the average Joe and Jane's income that is allocated to housing, energy, and food. So it is true that the cost of this cell phone may go down. It is true that the cost of McDonald's labor force may go down because they have kiosks. It is true that the cost of maybe a car may go down because we have autonomous driving. And therefore, on the margin, productivity may go up with people who are making over $100,000 a year. We won't have to have cab drivers. The cost of transportation will decrease. But at the end of the day, what percentage of the average Joe and Jane's paycheck will be impacted by those things that respond to technological advances bring the price down? I would argue maybe 10% of their paycheck, where 90% of their paycheck is going to be allocated to those prices where technology really doesn't move the needle. when costs and prices decline, velocity and disinflation, if not deflation, follow. If consumers and businesses, okay, so, and again, not all the time. So let's think this through. We saw declining prices in the 1800s. Did that create deflation? Yes, it did, but it also created nominal GDP growth and nominal wages increased. And notice I'm saying nominal wages, not adjusted for that deflation. So you can have an environment where velocity is increasing, money supply staying the same because nominal GDP going up, yet prices going down. If consumers and businesses believe that prices will fall in the future, they'll wait to buy goods. Give me a break. This is one of those things that is such an incredible fallacy, and it's so ridiculous. I don't even see how people continue to say it. It's like the wage gap. It's just been debunked so many times, and it's so just ignorant and naive. It's hard for me to really believe that we're still having this conversation, or people with reasonable intelligence are actually just repeating this drivel. I mean, just think that through, just using a little, just basic common sense. And this is where you can tell that if she's taken economic classes, which I'm sure she has, all of her teachers were Keynesians. So think about that. People will wait to buy goods and services. Really? Like, what good or service would you wait to buy because you thought the price would be lower in 6 months? Would you wait to buy gas? I don't think so. Would you wait to buy food? Nope. Would you wait to pay rent? Nope. Would you most likely wait to buy a car, even? Probably not. Would you wait to buy car insurance? Would you wait to buy health insurance? What would you actually wait to buy? Would you wait to buy clothing? Would you wait to buy a new pair of running shoes that you need because you got holes in the other one? Would you wait to buy soap? Would you wait to buy shampoo? Would you wait to buy shaving cream? You see what I'm saying? The only thing that people really wait to buy are assets if they think the price is going down. So if the price of gold is going down, if the price of Bitcoin is going down, if the price of housing is going down, and people think that it'll continue to go down in the future, yes, then they will wait. But as far as consumer goods, I mean, that doesn't even make any sense. No one waits. Kathy wouldn't wait to go buy that perfume that she needs or that business suit that she needs just because she thinks the price is going to go down in 6 months. That is utter nonsense. And mainstream economists just repeat that over and over and over again as though it's gospel, and people just kind of nod their head and don't even think about it. Now, I tell you one thing that affects consumer behavior, and that's prices up. Because when prices are going up, it is true, people will buy more. But they won't buy less if prices are going down. And here she references velocity again, as though that's kind of just written in stone. And that's where you can tell that if she's putting that much emphasis on velocity, most likely she does not understand the way dollars are created. And that would be indicative of what she said about the mistake she made in 2008. Final factor that should lead to deflation is the stockpiling of goods due to the pandemic and supply chain bottlenecks. Okay. Again, are they stockpiling because they're worried about supply chain bottlenecks in the future? Or are they stockpiling because they're worried about prices going up in the future? And therefore, this exacerbates the problem. And this is the feedback loop that you get when you combine that with psychology of market participants that really ignites inflation. That's what we saw in the 1970s. Because businesses shut down and were caught flat-footed, consumption took off during the Cerveza sickness. They still are scrambling to catch up. Probably, I don't think so. If you go look at the grocery store, I mean, Whole Foods, yes, some of their shelves are barren. They don't have anything there. But is this a result of something that happened back in 2020 that they're now just catching up? No, because I saw all that stuff there and over, you know, 6 months ago, and now it's not there. So I don't think the issues the grocery stores are having today are representative of the same problem they may have had in 2020. Then she goes on to say, as a result, once holiday season passes, the companies face excessive supplies. Prices should unwind. Some commodity prices, lumber, iron ore, already have dropped 50%. Yeah, they've dropped 50%, but they're still way up. I mean, lumber might not be, but iron ore is. Like, I was just checking it today. So if something goes up by 100% in a year and then comes down by 10%, is that really deflation? I mean, I don't think so. And then she talks about the oil price. So bottom line here, to answer the original question, is I do not think she is right. I do not think we will see significant consumer price deflation right after Christmas. And I think the probability is most high that we will continue to see inflation. We might have a slight disinflation, meaning that we have the prices are still going up. They're going up at a little slower rate. But I think the hope that these supply chains will be fixed through just the course of time or through higher prices like they normally would in a free market economy, I think that's wishful thinking, because the government is, in my opinion, is going to create more regulation. They're going to create more economic distortions, which will lead to more malinvestment, more misallocation of resources, including a shortage of labor. And if these things continue, it's the definition of insanity. We're just doing the same things over and over and over again and just hoping for different results. But I think the results will be identical to what we saw in 2020 and 2021. Kathy Wood is a symptom of inflation. Yeah, that's actually interesting. I think she is a symptom of the Fed keeping interest rates artificially low and the Fed taking their balance sheet up to $8 trillion and the market responding to that. I don't think there's a direct correlation with the Fed's, or I don't think there's a causal effect, I should say. There's probably correlation between the Fed's balance sheet and the stock market, but I don't think there's a direct causal component. There is a psychological component, and the Fed, I think, manages that through what we call expectations policy. But, you know, Jeff Snyder pointed this out the other day, and I think it was just so simple that it was just brilliant, like many of the things Jeff says. Says, just any person out there, show me how the Fed's balance sheet increasing directly affects the stock market. Just show me. And the argument there would be, well, oh my gosh, all the banks are able to lend all this money to the hedge funds, and then the hedge funds go out there and buy stocks and risk assets. Well, that would assume, and now these are my words, not Jeff's, but that would assume that they were constrained to begin with. That would assume that they were balance sheet constrained, meaning that they only had a specific amount of reserves and like, oh my gosh, we really, really want to loan you that $1 billion, but oh my gosh, we can't because we just don't have enough bank reserves. Said no bank ever, or at least not in the last 10 years. So why do I say that? Because if you look at the amount of reserves banks are holding with the Fed, over $4 trillion. Contrast that to prior to the GFC, it was around $40 billion. $40 billion with a B. Now it's $4 trillion with a T. So there's no way these banks are balance sheet constrained. And there's no way that just by the Fed doing more quantitative easing, they somehow are able to lend any more than they were before the Fed did the quantitative easing in the first place. So it's all psychological. And I think this is a great point here, that if we would not have seen that intervention from the Fed, or let's say the central planners, creating artificially low interest rates and then doing all this quantitative easing that does have a psychological impact on the market, would Cathie Wood, would she even be a thing? And my guess is no. I mean, but you can say that with so many people. Look at Elon Musk. I mean, whether you like him or you don't, the bottom line is Tesla would not be Tesla unless it were for artificially low interest rates and the Fed pushing everyone out the risk curve since the GFC. Tesla would not be here. WeWork would not be here. I mean, half the companies that have gone public, if not more, over the last 2 years would not even be in business if it wasn't for what the Fed has done since 2008. So, you know, Rick Rule, my good buddy, has the best way to frame that. He says, never confuse brains with a bull market. And so many people look at everyone out there and say, oh my gosh, they're a genius. They're a genius that of that. They're a genius, genius, genius. Really? Are they a genius? Or were they just at the right place at the right time? She's just a gambler. Honestly, if I had to give my assessment, and I've never spoken with Cathie, but just from the quotes I've seen on CNBC or what I've heard her say just through other interviews, I mean, listen, this is a game of AUM. It's a game of assets under management. And it's just like Ross Gerber, same thing. I mean, I wouldn't put her in the same category as that guy. That guy's really, I don't like that guy at all. I don't think he's really principled, to say the least. But it's just a game of AUM. What story can you tell to get maximum assets under management? Or Cham Spacketh, same thing. Or Chameth, or what I call him Cham Spacketh because he was doing so many SPACs and I was making fun of him on my whiteboard videos a couple months ago. But it's the same thing with Cham Spacketh. Everyone loves him. They think he's the Silicon Valley darling. He's a genius. He's this, he's that. He says all the right things. He's interviewed by all the right people. So then he comes out and he just says, oh, I'm doing a SPAC. Everyone gives him $1 billion. And then he goes out and buys some BS company like the house flipping business. I forgot what it was called, but he bought that house flipping business. That's the first time that I was kind of on to his game because I know house flipping very, very well. And I know there's no way a large corporation can do that and make profit. It just over the long run, it ain't going to happen. So when he came out on CNBC with his recent SPAC and said that he bought this house flipping business and how great it was and how their tech was going to revolutionize this and revolutionize that, as someone who has had a lot of experience flipping houses, to the point where I had my own TV show doing it. Let's remember that in 2019 in Medellin, Colombia. I knew that didn't pass the sniff test. And so now, of course, we see it playing out. What happened with Zillow? They had a house flipping business and they've put that on hold. Well, if they're making that much money, they most likely wouldn't have put that on hold, would they? The reason they put it on hold is because they see that, oh, wait a minute, we really can't make any money here. But now who's coming out smelling like roses? It's going to be Cham Spacketh. Because even if that company tanks, he still gets a large fee for doing the deal in the first place. And while we're waiting for it to tank, he's taking 2% as far as a management fee on the total amount of assets under management. So that's the game. It's not that you have to be a good investor today. You have to have a good story. You have to be a good salesman. Being a good salesman is far more important in today's world than actually being a good investor. Do you think we are already in an inflationary feedback loop, beginning stages on the snake devouring itself? Well, that's what the 1970s was. I mean, it's not just one variable. It's all these variables that create this doom vortex, as I say on my videos, or Raoul Paul says a doom loop. You know, that's basically what we're talking about is a positive feedback loop with something that's just getting worse and worse and worse. And I think what we're seeing now is all of the government distortions from 2020 and the beginning of 2021, it's all coming home to roost. And so the question is, are they going to stop doing what created the problems in the first place? No, they're going to double down. Just look at what's happening with the medicine mandates. That's just doubling down. And if the government doubles down, it's safe to assume that they're just going to make things worse. And if things get worse, then that's going to have a larger psychological impact on the general public. The more they are cognizant of inflation, the more that creates a different incentive structure, or that changes consumer behavior to where they start buying things or more of things for the future today. And then you see wages go up, and then you see this feedback loop that you're referring to. So I do agree that that feedback loop has started. Usually you could get off of that road if the government would just pull back and stop doing the things that made the problem in the first place. But like I said, they're doubling down. So I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. What was the name of the whiteboard where you did the 1920s income as compared to today? I wanted to send that to a friend. I'm not sure. 1920s income. I don't know if I did 1920s or late 1800s, but I don't recall, Bill. I apologize. I've done how many, Josh? Maybe 400 whiteboard videos. I don't know, but the one comparison I really like to do is how nominal wages went up in the late 1800s after the Civil War, while at the same time the prices of goods and services went down by 2-3% compounded. And how that really improves the standard of living for the poor and middle class compared to inflation going up, which destroys the poor and middle class. Okay, guys, enjoy the rest of your afternoon and make sure you're always standing up, fighting for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism.